This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is July 2nd, 1997. I'm with Archie Haller. We're in the Wharf building today. They're doing some construction at Goodnight Hall, so we've moved our location. We're going to start talking today. It turns out that Dr. Haller had spent 12 years in this building, as sociology or rural sociology had been moved over here. Let's start out telling a little bit about the whole background, and you had some incidents regarding the student unrest that you wanted to relate as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that had, things I guess are connected with each other in right. strange ways sometimes. But going to our move out here, when the bombing took place on Sterling Hall, there was a lack of space everywhere. We had research, our Department of Rural Sociology was squeezed into a small amount of space for faculty in Ag Hall, and we had an overflow area over in King Hall, which was close by. Mm-hmm. And we had research operations there, and we just had, as of July 1st, we had just brought in two new professors, one of them from the University of Illinois, another one from Princeton, and they both had very large research operations with them, all kinds of equipment and so forth that they brought in, because they brought projects with them at the time, and I was chair at the of the department, had been since July 1st at that time, excuse me, but we were told that that we were going to have to give up our King Hall space because somebody else needed it as a consequence of these rolling consequences mm-hmm. of the bombing. So we were offered space out here in the Wharf building, but only after January 15th of 1971, as I remember, must have been then. And what we did was split the department. We brought those two new professors out here. I would have had to split my research, or if I'd kept an office for research over in Ag Hall, in the first place it would have been pretty tight there, and other people would have suffered if I'd done that. Second place, I would have been split off from my research people, and I didn't want that. And so I came out here with David Featherman and Gene Summers, mm-hmm. Who were faculty members. Then Gene is still here. And when we brought our research people and whatnot out here, we had about half a floor here mm-hmm. on the sixth floor. Well, and so we stayed here for a long time until finally the college had some more moves of departments here and there, and in particular agricultural economics moved out of Ag Hall, and that gave us some space there, and the department moved back and came back together. But the other thing that I wanted to mention, that it doesn't appear anywhere in the, and I don't know that, well, a few people obviously know it, but I don't know any of the living people, at any rate, who are aware of what I'm about to say. And that is that a year before the bombing of Sterling Hall took place, I was in a conversation with one of our faculty members, whose name was Gene Havens, and he told me something at that time that I found shocking. I remember this is a year before the bombing. One other thing about Gene, he had been a lieutenant colonel in the ROTC at Iowa State or something like that, as I remember, and he had an obligation to be in the military during the Vietnam War, and he didn't like that, but he finally went into it. But when he came back, he seemed to be a changed person completely. I have some other stories about Gene Havens and things that he told me, but I don't know whether I believe them or not. But this one I believe, because it was this particular event was a year before, as I recall, before the bombing took place, and Gene kind of breathlessly told me that he had been at a meeting of the crazies at that time, and the crazies were talking about bombing and burning the Land Tenure Center. Indeed, that had been tried once before. Somebody did throw and the Land Tenure Center at the time these things took place was in King Hall. Somebody earlier had thrown firebombs inside of it, and of course it didn't happen that and no serious damage happened at that time. So the idea of burning or bombing the Land Tenure Center was not a new one at the time that this conversation with Gene Havens took place. Now, he was associated with the Land Tenure Center, and at any rate, in the kind that what he said was that in the meeting with these crazies, and I have no idea how many people were there. Maurice Zeidlin apparently was there and must have given a speech. Gene Havens was there, gave a speech. There must have been, my vague recollection is Gene said there were 100 or more crazies at the meeting. And that's the term crazies is the term he used. Mm-hmm. He told me that they had a move to bomb the Land Tenure Center, but he decided to get up and give a speech telling them not to bomb the Land Tenure Center, but rather to bomb Army Math. And I've mentioned this to a couple of people within the last 3 or 4 years. I had not wanted to talk about it because, well, at the time, it could have been taken as something kind of moderately idle. But it took a year before the Army Math was actually bombed. And it may be that his speech had nothing to do with it, even though he did say that he had told the crazies to do that. But at any rate, this doesn't appear in any of the literature anywhere. Yeah, I didn't do anything about it because I couldn't see that it would have any legal consequences at all. And I only remembered it in retrospect when the bombing actually took place a year later.
I bet you did.
sure. But the bombing itself, I'll add just a quick word. I awoke at what, something like 3:15. We live about 5 miles or so from Sterling Hall. And I heard a boom and woke up and I thought, isn't that strange? It didn't look like it was going to storm tonight. And I went back to sleep at about 6 a.m. I got a frantic call from the wife of a police officer who was a neighbor saying, screaming over the telephone that they bombed Sterling Hall. And of course, then things took off from there. Uh-huh. And we had our issues about reorganizing space and all kinds of things at that time.
Yeah, I think people aren't quite aware, they forget about the ramifications, like you said, almost the rolling effect that this had on just space alone within the university. Mm-hmm. And we're talking damage control, we're talking about it at about 25 different levels, you know, from a PR level to trying to figure out where people are going to have their offices to
right.
Tremendous consequences.
Yeah, I want to say one more thing about consequences, and that is that up until the bombing, the bulk of the students really didn't know who to believe. They tended to believe the few radicals who were pretty good orators, among mm-hmm. other things, mm-hmm. and probably pretty courageous people too. Although I'm sure some of them had their own games that they wanted to play, but and the country as a whole was so unused to this kind of divisive situation that a lot of official responses to rallies and things like that were really overdone. And we had events such as in 1967 where the Dow Chemical riots took place. We had other riots about that time. But in other words, up until the bombing, the bulk of the students thought that these radical leaders, who were really relatively few compared to all of the students, were Robin Hoods, mm-hmm. With no weapons mm-hmm. and so forth, facing a brutal and very well armed establishment. Well, then when the bombing took place, immediately after that, a woman whose name I don't remember now if I ever knew, who was editor, as I recall, of the Cardinal, got on the radio, and she said, by the time she was on the radio, it was already known that this one fellow had been killed in the bombing. And she got on the radio, and she said in a most callous way, this is war. Of course people get killed in war. Too bad. The students were appalled. Mm-hmm. All over the nation, not just mm-hmm. here in Madison, but all over the nation. The students who had taken the leadership among other young, the young leadership of the revolutionary movement as Robin Hoods, suddenly saw them as the face of evil as well. Mm-hmm. So that didn't change their opinion of the establishment, it changed their opinion of the former Robin Hoods. And it killed the student movement, the student revolutionary movement all over the country.
Yeah, that was really the nail in the coffin, wasn't it? The Sterling Hall thing.
Yes, it was for the nation as a whole. Yeah. I suppose people have written this up, but I really haven't seen it. It must be in magazines of various sorts. Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, that's about what I wanted to say on that. Okay, then you asked
one question I wanted to ask. You said that the crazies were talking at that meeting about bombing the Land Tenure Center. Why did they choose that? Why did they say that?
Well, as I recall, the argument that was being made at that time, and I heard this in a meeting of some of the people who were questioning the Land Tenure Center, along with Land Tenure Center personnel, as I believe the director of the LTC was there at the time, and other professors who were associated with it. And what they were saying was that the Land Tenure Center, for example, had more objective information on Bolivia than you could find in Bolivia itself. And they were saying that they resented this inequality of information, and the fact that Bolivia, all of this information should have been in Bolivians instead of here in the United States in the Land Tenure mm-hmm. Center. That was the reason that was given. At the time, it was probably more than that, and this goes back to something else. The Land Tenure Center was, I don't remember the exact funding, but it was authorized by Congress, as I recall. I was not here when that authorization took place. But at any rate, I think the funding was probably through the State Department at that time, and there was a lot of criticism of the State Department. May I switch to another one of the touchy period things of that
sure
period?
Can.
As you know, because we've talked about them before, one of the most brilliant students that we ever had the pleasure of working with is Alejandro Portas.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in Cuba, came to the United States when he was 15, went through college, and then came here at age 20 as a beginning graduate student, and he wound up coming on as my research assistant when he came here. A very bright fellow. He told me when he came here what he wanted to do for his PhD thesis, thinking 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. ahead. He was the most knowledgeable young person I think I ever met about almost anything. At any rate, Alex said that when he was ready to do a PhD thesis, he wanted to go to Chile, and he wanted to study the political and social attitudes and behaviors of people in what was called the Cayampas, which were the slums that were growing up all over Latin American major cities. And the Cayampas was the name for those slums, shanty towns, in Santiago, Chile. And the reason he wanted to do the studies in Chile was because Chile was the only place in the Americas where all parties were legal, so that it was you could get what their statements of their voting behavior was and so forth, and you had the full spectrum from the extreme right to the extreme left. Well, when, as he went through his coursework and his research, he did absolutely brilliant work. The article that he and I and Bill Sewell published in 1969, which was based on an analysis that, that Alex and I had done on Bill's data, done in 1966 or so, and finally, but published in the journals a little bit later on. But anyway, that had a big impact on the literature. But Alex did things by himself. He entered in a theoretical debate with a British, a leading British psychometrician at the time, and in the journals, and he did a project over in on his own over in Milwaukee, which was made a big splash in the literature. All these while he was still a graduate student. Well, come time for his and one of the things that happened was that amongst all of the a number of the Spanish American people from Colombia and Peru in particular, but mostly Colombia, who weren't so sure they were really interested in sociology. They were much more interested in reading Marx in Spanish, and they also occupied the King Hall at that time. Well, they obviously got very jealous of him, and because he was doing well, and if you were a Latin American, you were supposed to hate statistics and hate serious research and so forth, because if you were going to change the world, and you don't change it by research. Well, he got a grant from MUSEA with land tenure support, and the Land Tenure Center had an office in Santiago, Chile, so he went to Santiago for his PhD thesis, and he did just that on it. While he was there, somebody who was here in Madison in King Hall was writing letters to the Maoist newspaper and to the Soviet lining newspaper in Santiago, attacking Alex's work. And I have copies of these things that appeared in the newspapers there, because he sent them to me. But the argument was that Alex was working for the Land Tenure Center. The Land Tenure Center, and with a MUSEA grant, then the Land Tenure Center and MUSEA were funded by the State Department. The State Department was under the control of the CIA, and therefore he was a CIA agent. And if you break down the argument, yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah. Well, he slept with a pistol under his pillow for a while, and I never knew exactly why, but in general it was because the students in Santiago were being incited by people in Madison to attack his work. The decision they finally made was to do all the interviewing for him, accept his money, and then burn the interviews. And but he got wind of it, and photoed all of the pages of his interviews. This was the first empirical study that was done by any foreigner in Chile after the Camelot affair, and which caused some groups in the United States were looking at revolutionary potential in Latin America, and they were funded by, I guess, federal money somewhere or other. I don't know how. But it caused the Camelot affair, the studies of revolutionary potential, caused a big scandal in the country at that time. And then his study was the first one, I think, after that, and to be conducted by a foreigner. At any rate, I have to tell a related story. There was one Danilo Salcedo who had been a graduate student here, and he professed to be leftist. I guess he was. I don't know. I really don't pay too much attention to people's politics in the academic situation, because that's not our business. Our business is to understand the politics, but not to interfere in them. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, Danilo was, if he was a leftist, was one of the few of those periods, and now we're going back in the early 50s, who was one of the few who was quantitatively sophisticated. He knew what numbers were all about. Well, he left here, and He and I were friends. He used to criticize everything around him, but he and I were friends, and I felt he was a good, honest, decent person. Well, after a long set of things that took place one after the other, Danilo was back in Chile, a Chileno, and I think at the time that Alex was down there, he was dean of the social sciences in the University of Chile. At any rate, he had a high administrative mm-hmm. position. Danilo then wrote me a letter, and he said, "What about this fellow Alejandro Portas? You tell me what you know about him. If he's on the level, if you say he's on the level, I'll back him. If you say he's not, well, we're going to let things happen." And so I wrote him a long letter back, and I told him what I know about Alex, about what I've just mentioned here to you, about his what I knew about his history. And of course, I'd never really probed his history. The only things he ever told me, they were in conversations, things come up, so you learn a little bit. But I knew that his father had been superintendent of schools in Havana before Castro came in, and that was the reason why his family had to leave. But more than that, I didn't really know very much. Well, Danilo then did exactly what he said he would do. He backed Alex. And I, without that backing, you see, Danilo then was respected by the leftists mm-hmm. because he was viewed as a leftist himself. He probably was one. And he was also dean, or this relatively similar position. So when Danilo then backed Alex Portas's work, and then Alex took his own precautions too, it went wide. Now that research is still reverberating in the literature, because what he the things he discovered from those analyses just had a huge impact on thinking about on the thinking of the theoreticians and the practical people about what life is like in the slums and what it is that slum people want out of life, how they got there, what they hope to do, so you can break their ways through it. And before his research, the sociological, political science, and anthropological literature was essentially a bunch of mythology and impositions made by scholars who thought they knew what these people mm-hmm. thought and behaved like, but in fact didn't really know very much about them at all. Well, at any rate, as I said, Alex's work then and his work continues to be just splendid. He's he's changing from chair of the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins over to Princeton at the moment.
Oh my.
Well, those are the two little stories I wanted to.
Now, you said his research down there had such ramifications on the practical and the theoretical side. Did he do more or less the anthropological type of research that we've talked about in previous interviews, where he goes down there and observes as well as
anthropological?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
And was that part of the unique, fact that he's actually down there recording his observations? Or what made it so unique?
Well,
his findings or his methodology, or both?
Well, our group, myself, Alex, and some others, we really don't spend very much time talking about the informal interviews that we do, mm-hmm. or we don't even write about those. Mm-hmm. What we write about are the formal things, mm-hmm. the sampling techniques, the questions that are asked on interview schedules, the way they are coded, and just this very straightforward technical material. His work was very well informed by the kinds of informal observations and interviews that he had taken with all kinds of people, but you don't really know that in any direct way unless you really stop to think about mm-hmm. it and you wonder mm-hmm. how it is that he could come up with the right questions. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would add one other thing. Before he conducted this study, remember this fellow by 1970, when he, well, 1969, I guess, when he was doing his field research in Santiago, he was only 24 years old. He went to the political leadership of every party in Santiago, the right, the middle, and the left, and told them what he was doing and got their okay to go ahead with the project. He did his homework in the Cayampas and with other kinds of people, the elites and the poor and so forth. That's what we try to do, but we don't write it up to any great extent. Yeah. We just don't write it up.
Well, that's the background. That's the subtext, I guess, is one way of writers mm-hmm. talk about that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Now, you mentioned one thing. I just have to know how it ended up. You said that he had heard it had been, someone had informed him that they were going to burn the interviews, the notes on the interviews afterward. And then he made copies. Did they indeed burn the notes?
I don't remember. I don't recall. I think not. I think he got them out of. I don't know. I just don't know.
Note I wanted to quote.
If he ever comes back here, ask him.
Okay. We're back on tape. We were off tape, and we got on to somehow George Amano's book, Shepherds of the Night.
I wanted to mention that that book is, I think it ought to have some, be ought to be recognized by the social scientists. When he wrote that, the beliefs about how shanty towns were being established, coming into being and just appearing suddenly sometimes in, over fairly large tracts of land, in Lima, in Salvador, in Rio, in Santiago, Chile, and another great city, Bogota, the beliefs about how those happened were a mystery to the social scientists, and a number of them were speculating about it, both the Latin American social scientists and so forth. Well, Giorgio Amado scooped all of them because mm-hmm. he wrote a first-rate mm-hmm. description in Shepherds of the Night about the establishment, occupation, and later destruction mm-hmm. of one of these shanty towns. And this was before any of the formal social scientific literature came out on it. Eventually they discovered that the process, but it was exactly what he had described.
Interesting. Well, I always knew there was a reason I liked that book so much.
Oh, Giorgio Amado is a wonderful writer. He's not, in my judgment, he's not the greatest writer of Brazil. The greatest writer of Brazil, in my judgment, is João Guimarães Rosa, who wrote a book called Grande Sertão Veredas, which is, Brazilians all say it's unreadable, but it's not unreadable. is translated with an awful title in English. It's as good a translation as you could get, but the title is "The Devil to Pay in the Backlands," and it's Knopf Publishers. That's a great book in the sense it's got these deep Western and Mideastern themes that go through it, but it takes place in the Brazilian backcountry, and the people are all illiterate. Mm. And it is a Faust story. Mm. The fellow who's the key figure in it believes he has a pact with the devil, but you never know.
Oh.
But at any rate, it's a good book. I think that he's the greatest of the writers. I would have to say that, you may remember that I'd said that in one of our meetings that my friend José Israel Vargas, who's now the Minister of Science mm-hmm. and Technology, he and I got to be friends because we were discussing a book.
Oh, really?
It was that book.
The Devil to Pay in the Backlands?
Yeah, Grande Sertão Veredas, yes. And And I had said that I thought that was a wonderful book. And then I made the comment I've made two or three times to other people that I have my little middle list about those that deserve A's, those that deserve B's, and so forth. And I thought, well, there are only a handful of books that I among the ones I've read that I would call A's. And they include Tolstoy's War and Peace and the Brothers Dostoevsky and one or two of Thomas Mann's things. And I said, and I would include Juan Guimarães Rosa as an A, too. And Vargas then started talking about, we were driving through the countryside here and, at the time, and Vargas then started talking about Juan Guimarães Rosa, and he said, finally, but see, he'd read all the things, read a lot that I hadn't read, too. It was Vargas is not only a nuclear physicist and statesman, but also one of the few genuinely educated men I've ever met in my life. And but then he eventually said, oh, you know.
We're going to turn now to your fellowships and consultancies. You noted in the biographical sketch that you gave me a couple months ago now that you had been awarded Fulbright professorships in Brazil in 74, 79, 83, 87, 88, and 90. Let's talk for a few minutes about these Fulbrights, how you went about obtaining them, the value of them to your research, and anything else.
Well, yeah, let me give the context again. I think I've given part of this, but when I arrived here, Professor Kolb had already been involved in Brazil research and what came to be a real Brazil program of the Department of Rural Sociology had actually been begun when João Gonçalves de Souza came to Madison to study with Kolb back in 1944. And João rose to be Minister of State and some other things as time went on. But I had mentioned that we were working on what came later to be called status allocation or status attainment processes, but working on American data. And Kolb had his graduate students here. Well, I was doing some talking with one of his graduate students because Kolb asked me to advise the student because Kolb was too busy to do it. And when I listened to him, I became convinced that there were fast evolutionary changes going on in stratification in Brazil that our literature didn't make any allowance for. And I thought that, well, the same things must be happening in the United States, but for some reason we don't see them. And if they are indeed happening in the United States, that means that the status allocation processes that we are studying, and were still unnamed at that time, are taking place with respect to a rapidly changing structure, and we don't even know how to think about it. We don't even know how to look at it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, one of the things I ought to do is to go to Brazil sometime if I can do it, observe changes in stratification by talking to people and listening to people and by doing empirical research. And so after that I left here. I would work with Sewell instead of going to Brazil, as you know. But then when time for sabbatical came on, I had two choices. One of them was I was considering, and they would have led to very different kinds of careers, both of which I was really interested in, but only one of which was feasible because they were just each one was too much to handle, was enough to handle by itself. One of them was to go to University of Michigan and work with Anatole Rapoport, if he would permit it, and see if I could learn some things from his line of mathematical analysis that could be applied to sociology. The other one was to, in my sabbatical, would be to go to Brazil and work on the stratification problem, this changes in evolutionary changes in stratification. As it happened, I decided to go for the Brazil possibility and got in contact with João Gonçalves and with Kolb. Kolb by that time was no longer a professor, he was retired. And I was advised by them to apply for a Fulbright and to go to the same university where João was technically a professor, although he had never taught there because he was working for the Brazilian government in the Organization of American States in Washington instead. But also it was the same place that Kolb had done his field research, and I proposed repeating the parts of Kolb's research in exactly the same areas with the same sampling procedures and so forth that he had used, at least those parts of it that pertain to stratification, so that we could measure some changes that had taken place between 1953, when he and his students had gathered those data initially, and the time that I'd be there, which was 1962. Well, the Fulbright grant was granted, and so I did go there in 1962 and did the stratification research and worked with some very bright students and had lots of curious adventures. I'm going to recount one of them.
Yes, you're sitting there smiling, so I was going to say, you've got to tell me why you're smiling.
One of these days I'm going to write this up, but I call this one Bombing a Russian Helicopter. The rural university where I was about 50 kilometers outside of Rio de Janeiro. At the time we were there, the relationships between Brazil and the Soviet Union were fairly hot, and Americans were pretty generally hated at the time. They're not now. They haven't been for a long time. But this was a touchy period in Brazilian history, of food riots and all kinds of things going on. The Russians then decided to hold a huge fair in Rio de Janeiro, and so they brought their fair over to Rio, to the city of Rio, which I never attended. My wife and the girls who actually went to it, but I didn't get to it. I was working or something, but they brought their military contingents with them, and I don't know what all. In fact, they did fly one of their planes out to the rural university to brag about how they could put pesticides, use planes to deposit pesticides on their crops and so forth. The Brazilians laughed at them. They said, well, ours are more advanced than theirs anyway. While I was there, while the Russians were there, it turns out that my students in Michigan State, where I was professor at the time, and decided to have a beer party. Now, I didn't know anything about what was going on there, and they got a little bit drunk, and the university that I was in, the Rural University of Brazil, as it was called then, was having strike after strike after strike, but my classes went on because they didn't count for credit for anybody. So I went ahead and taught. Well, these people back in East Lansing got together and they decided to send a telegram to us and make a joke with us. Well, I didn't know anything about that, of course, but here one day, now how do telegrams at that time get to a place like the Rural University? The first place they were telegraphed to Rio, the city of Rio, then they were telephoned to an operator about 30 miles out of Rio, and then they were telephoned to the Rural University, and then they came. By the time this thing got to me, everybody in the university already knew about it. And what it said, this is a telegram, not identified, it said only address and so forth, and it said, S-C-A-P, the gang. I had no idea what it addressed to me. Mm-hmm. I had no slightest idea what this was. But at the same time that this happened, the Russians, within a day or so, the Russians had sent a helicopter from Rio de Janeiro up the escarpment to the city of Petropolis, and on the way up there it was bombed.
Oh my.
And with this unintelligible telegram, who were from no site that we could identify, that any could, everybody thought that this was a CIA signal, and was somehow connected with bombing the Russian helicopter. Eventually, we found out that what had happened is that these were graduate students. They didn't have any money except to spend on beer, I guess, and they got together and my wife had been writing to some of them who are also our friends, and so they had tried to send a telegram calling me Scab, S-A-C-A-B. But of course, we wouldn't have understood that either, but it didn't come out that way. It came out S-C-A-P, which is absolutely unintelligible. And later on, we found out what had happened.
Well, alcohol makes people do strange things sometimes.
Yeah, and you do see some... I'm always suspicious of coincidences myself, but this was a real
one.
Anyway, one of these days, I have a bunch of stories I want to write up about adventures and trying to do research in Brazil. My wife says I should write a, you know, she's Brazilian, she says I ought to write a book on stories because there's so many of them. But that's the one that's most fun of all.
That's great. So we're going to talk about the other. That was a 62 fellowship,
right?
Which I didn't mention when I gave my little intro question. We still have 74, 79, 83, 87, 88,
right.
And 90. And
well, then a number of very, very bright Brazilians started coming up to Madison. I sent a couple of them to Madison because I thought they should work with Wilkening and Sewell. Because I thought they could, they were supposed to be trained in rural sociology, and I thought that's the best training they could possibly get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I sent a couple of them up, but a university in the city of São Paulo also sent one or two up, and another university in the state of Minas Gerais sent one or two, so that a group of them were here. Then, and as I mentioned earlier, in the summer of 1964, I was invited back here to teach and do research for the summer, and came to the conclusion that in all respects, Wisconsin had become much more powerful for the kinds of things I was interested in than there was any place else in the world. And in terms of the computer support, the theoretical understandings, the understandings of careful empirical analysis, the contacts with Brazil, the teaching of Portuguese, and not the least of that was very, very bright students and from Brazil. Well, so I was major professor of some of these, and Wilkening was major professor of others, but we always worked on each other's committees. After I came back here a year later, mm-hmm. that is. In 1966, we were having meetings of the Rural Sociological Society and the American Sociological Association in Miami. José Pastore and Fernando Rocha and Elcio Saraiva and I got together, and we decided that four of us were going to do whatever we could do to support the development of a strong, empirical, and effective, conceptually effective sociology in Brazil. And we made a real agreement with each other to do that. Then time went on, and 1964 was it. And 65 were really rough years in Brazil. And there was a change over to a military government. The government that was that preceded it was a disaster, too, even though it was technically a democratic government. But then the military government came in, and they were really quite repressive and so forth. And I had mentioned that in the late 60s, I had become concerned that these very people, and also David Hansen, who was an American, had gone there, had gone to Rio Grande do Sul, were so occupied with just making a living that they couldn't use the knowledge that they had gained, and they couldn't possibly keep up with the changes in the field that were going on. They were going on very rapidly at the time. So I had written a letter to somebody in the Ford Foundation, and the Ford Foundation indeed put up some competitive research money in their office in Rio de Janeiro, and these people, José Pastore, Elcio Saraiva, David Hansen, all got research support. In 1970, José came up to Madison and he said that he wanted, would like to have me join him on a research project on the occupational positions and income of managerial and managerial support personnel in São Paulo's factories. And by that time, I had become concerned that we didn't, those of us who are working on these stratification issues empirically, didn't understand enough about money and power. And that was, I thought that was an opportunity to begin to think a little more systematically about such things and maybe learn how to feed that back into our regular research line. So I said, sure. And, so we did. And then in, what, I guess it was 74, we were finishing off the analyses, which were finally published, some of them in 1975, and we were beginning new work. By that time, the Brazilian National Statistical Service had a system for sampling a whole nation, and with probability samples and so forth. Well, Pastore by that time was on the faculty, not of sociology, because the our sociologists are not accepted by Brazilian sociologists, but they're welcomed by departments of economics.
Yeah,
well,
crazy.
José was in professor of sociology in the department of economics and administration, faculty of economics and administration by that time, and they arranged to have me come, they asked me if I would apply for a Fulbright. I did, and they supported it. And it happens that when an in-country, a credible in-country research and teaching agency wants to support a particular candidate, the Fulbright Commission pays a lot of attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means, I think, I sat on the evaluation committees later on too, so I saw how they operated. I think what that means really is if you get several very able people who are competing for the, who, though they don't know it, are competing for the same Fulbright, that the stronger the support is from some local agency, academic group, the more likely it is that's the person who's going to get the Fulbright. So that that really was with I applied for it and it was granted. And these same sorts of things happened later on too. And they were usually, well, the University of São Paulo was always involved in them after that. Even as I remember, one of them involved a lot of other places, but São Paulo was key to them, and José Pastore's position there was key to it too. And of course, he and I have we worked on a number of things as years have gone by, and we still are working together.
Well, I don't know much about that much about Fulbrights, and I was kind of surprised when I got your biographical sketch to see that you had been awarded what 7 Fulbrights. Is that a large number? I've never met anyone who's gotten like more than one or two or three, maybe.
Well, I think it's a large number. Yeah, Saul Levine has had a large number too. Yeah. I haven't counted them, but Saul is one of the world's experts on Japanese industrial relations and industrial relations generally, and I know that he's had a group of them. Both, I think, to Japan, but the Australians like him very much too, because they're finally discovering that they're in Asia and not in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. and also it's a little bit about how these are counted. This last three were really one application with three annual visits possible. In fact, I postponed one of them so that there were three visits over 1 year. But it's kind of hard to explain that in a three-inch sentence.
Were you, is this a comment, the number you received, does this reflect the Fulbright Committee's interest in Latin America? Were there a fair amount going to Latin America?
Oh, not very much.
South America?
There were some, but it's every place in the world, every country in the world where the United States has an agreement to have Fulbright professors. And the countries that are most sought after are no surprise. They're Britain, France, Italy, Austria, mm-hmm. Germany. Mm-hmm. And at least when I was on that committee later on, those are the ones that came up most in sociology. Japan would come up a little bit, Russia a little bit, but not much. And there are usually, over Latin America as a whole, maybe 9 or 10 mm-hmm. professorships that are open either for research or for teaching or both. So not each year there'll be a handful.
Have professorships, Fulbright professorships been cut back recently too? I know that there was talk of cutting back the student Fulbright awards.
Well, I haven't seen the legislation on it, but within the last 3-4 weeks there was a vote taken in Congress, I think the last couple of weeks, and Senator Feingold apparently strongly supported the international activities, including the Fulbright awards. The one of the people who's an official with the organization that does the evaluation of the Fulbright awards in Washington, the Committee on International Exchange of Scholars, I guess it's called now, had sent email to a number of people around the country asking that that we write to our senators, and I wrote one to Russell Feingold, and then I got an email back. The only thing I know about that, about the result, was in the email that I got back saying that they that the committee had supported it handsomely. So, but I don't know what that means in details. Yeah. So I wrote a letter back to Feingold, which was sent out last week by fax. One of probably a lot of letters that he's getting, I hope, thanking him for his support and pointing out that these Fulbright grants have been absolutely essential for the Brazil program of the Department of Rural Sociology, the University of Wisconsin. And I hope they keep it going in the future when I'm not around, but we'll see about that. I think that probably the funding is going to come out all right, but I don't know.
Yeah, for the little amount of money that goes into that thing, talk about bang for your bucks. It's one of the greatest foreign ambassador programs, goodwill ambassadors that you could come up with, but we shall see. Let's turn for now to you. You were a visiting fellow at the Australian National University in 1902. Let's just talk a little bit about how that came about.
I mean, here you are in Brazil, 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 and now all of a sudden you're stuck in the middle of down under land.
Well, Pastore and I decided we wanted to hold a meeting on social mobility research in São Paulo, and it was going to be a very small research meeting. We were thinking about people that we wanted to include in it, and Brazilians, and we were going to include one American, and we didn't know who it would be. I had had some correspondence with Jonathan Kelly at that time. We're back in 1972, 1973 now, but I didn't know him. I didn't know that I knew him personally. I had met him, in fact, but I wasn't aware of this. Jonathan Kelly is the one who was in Australia later on. But at any rate, one of our professors, David Featherman, who's really come to be quite an important figure in mm-hmm. the field, had written an article in the ASR, and he did a causal analysis, and he published it, but it didn't make much sense. Everything he did was correct, but it still didn't make much sense to us when we looked at it. And then this fellow Jonathan Kelly published a criticism of it in which he did a correction on the numbers, which was an innovative idea for correcting the numbers, and lo and behold, the pattern was just beautiful. So both Pastore and I paid attention to this, and we thought we better keep our eyes on this. We weren't talking with each other about Kelly, but independently we were keeping our eyes on him. So when this idea of the meeting came up over how to do social mobility research in the future, we asked Kelly if he'd like to join us. By that time he finished his PhD at Berkeley, and he did his undergraduate work at Cambridge University in England, and then he had worked at Columbia as a research assistant for one of the leading people in stratification research, and had found himself in the Department of Sociology, the Institute of Advanced Studies of Australian National University. Well, by this time by the time we had the meeting in Sao Paulo, he was not there. He was just finished with his PhD and was, I think, probably at Columbia at the time. But anyway, we asked Kelly if he would join our meeting, about half a dozen people or so. And for several days, we beat the area of social mobility research pretty heavily, and did some research planning, which resulted in a whole flock of things later on. And Kelly made really fine contributions to that meeting, and we decided we'd collaborate after that. So Kelly became part of our network, in effect. He and some of our research here in Madison, while he was still in the United States, he'd come up to Madison and write with us or analyze data and so forth. And so we did much of our research, our empirical research on Brazil, collaborative with basically Pastore and me, was either done in Madison or done in the University of Sao Paulo. Where it really got complicated, we'd do it in Madison because we had better equipment than Sao Paulo had. But a lot of it, they had pretty good equipment too, and a lot of it was done there. But that would bring, once in a while we would bring Kelly up here, or we'd bring Pastore up here, or I'd go down to Brazil. So he became really part of our network, and we're still working together. Yeah. And we were, by the late 70s, we were working on some research that was published later on the same kinds of stratification problems that we'd been digging away on for years and still dig on. But they had, that university had what was called a visiting fellow, I think it was called, available.
Visiting fellow. Yeah.
And they asked me if I would apply for it, and I had to go there and do research on Brazil. So I did. And I had a sabbatical coming up at that time, and so I took a 6-month sabbatical from here in Madison and went out there, and we got some good work accomplished at that time. And so we're going to come back to that in a little bit, and I know. But that's how I got out there.
Did Pastore go at all? Did he visit during your 6 months there?
That brings us to the next point. Okay. No, but I tried. Well, Kelly and I both tried to get things in motion to get Pastore out to the Institute, to Australian National University, to work with us. And that connection, I became acquainted with the officialdom from Brazil. Canberra's a very small place. It's a capital city of a country. Its population, about the city of the capital territory, is about the same as Dane County. Mm. And the population of the city is about the same as Madison. So, and they have all these diplomats there, and there's this great university there. So that's about all there is there, are diplomats and great university. It's turns to these people have all kinds of contact with each other because they don't have any chance of having contact with anybody else. It sits a couple hundred miles from each of the main cities. So at any rate, so I made attempts to get Pastore out to Canberra, And so we were in contact with him. And now we move to another subject, which you were going to ask about, and that is decorations from the Brazilian government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, during this same time, after I'd become acquainted with the Brazilian ambassador, who was a really nice fellow, very, very bright, too, and some other people connected with either formally or informally with the Brazilian embassy there, then I began seeing signs of being investigated by a government. Now, I knew what those signs were because, remember, in the Navy, I'd been involved in very secret things, mm-hmm. which were how radar worked,
right.
And radar was terribly secret at the time, and I had been, even as 17 and 18 year old, I had been investigated twice by the FBI. Mm-hmm. The reason I knew is because my mother would write letters to me telling me these people were out interviewing, these people and that people, these people and the others. And, so I began to see these funny signs of being interviewed or being investigated by a government. I thought, why in the world would anyone investigate me? But the only possibilities are the United States, Brazil, the Australians. Mm-hmm. But what in the world is there about me that they would want to investigate? I can't imagine. Then I went to the leading political scientist who was there at the time. He's now in the Department of Sociology at the University of Texas. But I went to him because I wanted somebody to know about this. And I told him, he thought it was ridiculous. He thought I was just out of my paranoid or something like that. But he didn't know that I had some experience with such things.
Right.
And so anyway, then we're still in contact with Pastore, trying to get Pastore over here. And then I went up to another university about 400 or 500 miles.